This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. In the first 24 hours of his administration, President Joe Biden signed a flurry of executive orders as part of his push to get the COVID-19 pandemic under control.
Our national strategy is comprehensive. It's based on science, not politics. It's based on truth, not denial, and it's detailed.
President Biden's plan includes a national vaccination campaign to administer 100 million shots in his first 100 days in office. That's enough to cover 50 million people with the vaccine requiring two doses. Biden's other COVID-related executive orders range from ramping up the development of therapeutics to treat the virus to requiring masks to be worn in federal buildings and on federal land. He's also created two new organizations, the National Pandemic Testing Board to improve testing capabilities and a COVID-19 Health Equity Task Force to make sure the COVID response is equitable. All of this is happening against the backdrop of a rising COVID-19 death toll, with President Biden himself saying it's likely to top 500,000 deaths next month. In the meantime, there's still a lot of confusion surrounding the COVID-19 vaccines and how they're being distributed across the United States. So we asked you, our listeners, what questions are on your minds as a new administration takes over the pandemic response. Here to help us answer some of your questions and more are Apoorva Mandavilli, science reporter at The New York Times, and Namanje Bumpus, director of the Department of Pharmacology and Molecular Sciences at Johns Hopkins University. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Namanje, let's start with you. There is a question that we've been hearing, whether or not once you get vaccinated, whether you can go back to life as quote unquote normal.
Yeah, that's the most common question, certainly. And the answer right now is even once you're vaccinated, we still have to continue with all of the social distancing measures. So face masks and being 6 feet apart, avoiding large groups. And the reason for that is that while we think it's very, I mean, these vaccines are amazing that are authorized, we think that it's very likely that they will reduce transmission. But in leading with science, we really need to get those data. So until we understand transmission after vaccination, we really need to maintain the distancing and the masking. And in addition, we have to understand how long the protection is going to last. So it's important for us to remain diligent and to really continue with our social distancing practices.
Apoorva, how many people need to be inoculated in the United States in order to achieve a level of immunity that allows for us to sort of get to closer to a sense of quote unquote normalcy?
So that number, Tanzina, is not a fixed number. Unfortunately, we don't have an exact estimate, but we do know that we probably need to get to around 70 or 80% with the current variants of the virus circulating in the United States. The problem is that herd immunity really depends on how quickly transmissible the or how transmissible the variants are. And so if we end up with a variant that is much more contagious, that may need to go up even more. What I can tell you is that we probably won't hit it until kids are immunized.
Namanje, let's talk about that because there is a lot of confusion, I think, for a lot of people, not just around the vaccine, but about these new variants that Apoorva is talking about. What do we know about the effectiveness? We know that vaccines mutate. We just don't know, I guess, how effective some of these vaccines are against some of the new COVID-19 variants. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, as you said, it's very normal for viruses to mutate, and that's something that we expect over time. And we are seeing these variants emerging, and some of them actually have a substantial number of mutations. What we know so far is that the vaccines that we have, we expect to work against these variants. And there is even some data released in the past few days showing that the Pfizer vaccine was effective against one of the variants. So I think that we expect the vaccines to work. There are questions about whether they will be somewhat less effective or not against the variants, but still expected to work and to be highly effective based on the variants we currently have. But certainly more studies and experiments are needed to test this exactly and to understand the precise numbers we're expecting as far as efficacy.
We're going to get into some listener calls in just a second. But before that, Apoorva, I'd love to ask you about the actual manufacturing of these vaccines. Do we have enough supply right now?
We probably have enough supply to get to the 100 million doses and more than that. But what happens later on, say in June, is a little bit still much of a question, because the problem is that it's not just the vaccine manufacturing capacity, as in just the vaccines. It's also things like glass vials and other things that are short supply. And some of that may be addressed by the Biden administration invoking the Defense Production Act, but there will probably be a ceiling on how much we can produce, at least for a short while.
And Apoorva, there have been a lot of back and forth between state officials and local officials here in New York, and I'm sure in other states, where there's just a lot of confusion about how much vaccine should be available, who's the priority group, who isn't. Are you seeing that across the country?
Absolutely. It's been very chaotic everywhere. And the problem has been that we haven't had really clear directions from the federal government. We, you know, the CDC outlined some priority groups, but there wasn't a lot of clarity about what localities should do once the vaccine comes into their hands. So it has been kind of chaotic. I've written about, for example, academic medical centers deciding to give the vaccine out to their own grad students who maybe don't even come in contact with patients, while at the same time we have people who are 85 years old who haven't been vaccinated. On the other hand, there's also an argument to be made for just vaccinating as many people as we can, as quickly as we can. So it's not a clear answer on which is better.
Nemanjay, let's listen to some of our questions that some of our listeners have. We had a Corrine gave us a call asking about antibodies. Let's take a listen to what Corrine's question is.
What makes the vaccine's antibodies any better than my antibodies that I got from actually getting COVID? Why would I need to get a vaccine if my body has already produced antibodies?
Nemanjay?
That's a good question. So we want to do better than natural immunity, essentially. And it's not clear currently what the strength of the protection are and the duration of protection after you just naturally have infection with SARS-CoV-2. So the idea being that the vaccine could provide stronger and longer lasting immunity than just recovering from the disease itself. And we certainly have vaccines that we currently use that we know that they provide immunity that is stronger than natural infection. So we're looking to do better. And that's why it's important for folks to get the vaccine, even if they have been previously infected.
We're going to take another call from Pete in Orlando. Let's listen to what his question is.
This is Pete from Orlando, and I have a simple yes or no question. After getting vaccinated, is it still possible to become infected and spread the disease?
Nemanjay, sounds like a simple yes or no. Is it?
Well, I wish. So like we said earlier, that we don't know about the transmission piece yet. But certainly there is a very, very small possibility of infection. You know, we know that the risk of infection is decreased, you know, 94-95% by these vaccines. So highly, highly effective, more than we could have dreamed of. But there are still, you know, slight chances. And we still aren't clear about the data after, you know, just one dose. So there is a chance of getting the disease. But the good news is that the vaccine is going to not only reduce your chance of getting sick, but if you were part of that very, you know, rare group to end up getting sick, that you won't have, you know, the level of symptoms that people have that aren't vaccinated. But we still don't know about that transmission piece.
Big question coming in from Brooklyn, Damani in Brooklyn. Let's take a listen to what Damani's question is. A lot of folks have this similar question.
Hi, my name is Damani. I'm calling from Brooklyn. What are the side effects that we can expect from having this vaccine?
Nemanjay, big question.
You know, obviously people experience pain at the injection site, and that's common. But particularly after the second dose, there are many people that experience things like headache, fatigue, and chills. So that tends to be mild to moderate, lasting only a couple of days. So not anything severe to be expected, but there are these side effects that, you know, we anticipate basically when you're really ramping up this immune response.
Apoorva, we sort of touched on this earlier, this who is getting the vaccine right now. And I know in New York, where I live and I'm trying to get my parents a vaccine, it has been complicated, to say the least. There are a number of websites where people can sign up, and then we ran out of the vaccine, so thousands of appointments were canceled. Is that confusion also something that you're seeing, just the mechanics of trying to get a vaccine across the country?
That is happening absolutely everywhere. One of my colleagues, David Leonard, who writes the morning newsletter for The Times, actually drove his mother halfway to Colorado, and his sister met him halfway and took her to Colorado so she could be vaccinated in Colorado instead, where she was eligible to get the vaccine too, because it was just so confusing here. And that's happening across the country, that people just really don't know how to get the vaccine. Some of the websites ask for a ton of information. And if we're really trying to vaccinate the elderly who may not be very tech savvy, it's a real barrier to getting to them. And we're also not vaccinating communities of color. For example, I just got an email a couple of days ago saying that the clinics in Washington Heights are actually seeing mostly white people because they can afford to, you know, sit at a computer and keep refreshing until they get an appointment and show up, whereas the clinic is actually intended for the communities that live nearby, which are mostly people of color.
Talk a little bit about that refreshing screen, because someone said to me, just keep hitting refresh. And I said, that's what I have to do to get an appointment for my parents? Explain that again.
Yeah, people have been comparing this to trying to get, you know, tickets to rock concerts back in the day, where you just sit and just keep refreshing until you
I wasn't the only one who compared it to trying to get tickets to Bon Jovi in 1985. I'm glad to know that, Apoorva.
It's unfortunate, right? It's actually really sad that that's the system that we have. I'm not really sure why it's this bad. I'm not sure why we didn't have an app that everybody could just put their information and get a number in the queue and just know when your time is. It doesn't seem like something we can't solve given all the other kinds of technology and apps we have available.
We're going to get into a little more of this in the next conversation, but you mentioned David Leonhard drove his mother across the country. Can people do that? Can you drive to another state and get vaccinated there?
Oh, well, I want to be clear that in his case, his mother used to live in Colorado or lives in Colorado part of the time and has residency there. So it's not that, you know, you can just go anywhere and get the vaccine, and you really shouldn't.
I was just going to say we might start seeing a lot of movement. We need to clarify that. We have a caller, Evelyn, who has another question for us. Let's take a listen.
My husband and I both tested positive for COVID on December 28th. When should we get the vaccine? And should we get another test to see if we're still positive?
Namanje, the question, I think, is a very specific one, but it does beg some information about timing of the vaccine. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so I think, you know, always talk to your healthcare provider, but essentially the suggestion is to, if you have a history of SARS-CoV-2 infection, that vaccination should be deferred until after you've recovered from the acute illness, so after you don't have symptoms and you've met criteria to discontinue isolation. So if you know, if your doctor says you don't need to be in isolation anymore, you know, you've recovered from those acute symptoms, then you certainly can and would be eligible for vaccination as long as you meet other local eligibility criteria based on the rollout. People also are asking about other vaccinations that they're getting, you know, for various things. And so the recommendation right now, since we don't know the interaction between this vaccine and other vaccines, just from kind of a pharmacology perspective, it's being recommended to wait 14 days in between vaccinations if possible. But sometimes there will be a need maybe to get another vaccine more quickly. And so folks can work with their healthcare provider on that.
Apoorva, I'm going to give this next question to you because it really talks about timelines and distribution. So let's take a listen to what Tim asked.
Hello, this is Tim from Jacksonville, Florida. I definitely agree with the priority being placed that medical personnel, emergency personnel, and seniors get the first wave of the vaccine. That's the low-hanging fruit. That's the easy choice. Now, my question is, who's the second group, third group, fourth group to get the vaccine?
Apoorva, how are we managing here rollouts to wider populations?
Well, after the elderly, we sort of had a next category of 65 plus, and the idea is to also vaccinate people with underlying conditions, essential workers of all types. You know, that could be subway employees, they could be, I mean, metro underground employees, and all kinds of people who will differ from state to state. For some states, those essential workers will be meatpacking plant employees. And, you know, that's the ideal. And then there is what's actually happening, as we've discussed. It's not actually unfolding in that way. And there are people who are getting signed up, hospitals are vaccinating all of their patients, not just people who are really in need. And so it will be inequitable. I think that seems almost inevitable right now. And maybe that's okay, because like I said earlier, there is a real argument to be made for just vaccinating as many people as possible so we can inch a little closer to herd immunity. The thing about, you know, vaccinating people is that it's not just the ultimate herd immunity point at which we start to see benefits. We will start to see a decline in the number of cases and hospitalizations and deaths as we vaccinate more and more of the population.
Apoorva, there are certain populations that have become a little bit controversial in whether or not they should be prioritized. Among them are people who are incarcerated and agricultural workers. You mentioned meat factory workers, but a lot of workers who are working in those factories and working in agriculture are also people who tend to be undocumented. Have both of those groups had any clarity around whether or not they will be eligible, and if so, when, for the vaccine?
Again, this has differed really state by state. Some states have decided that, for example, in their prisons, only the staff will be vaccinated and the prisoners will not. And some states have decided that that's not exactly equitable, and it's not, it's a human rights violation in a way to deny them the vaccine when they're living in congregate settings and they are choosing to vaccinate all of their prisoners. So it's really been variable. And I'm sure you can tell from my answer that I sort of side on the side of, yes, we should be vaccinating all the prisoners, because we know that when people live in close quarters, they are at high risk.
Namanjay, some listeners are saying that they were trying to get the vaccine. They were on very long lines to get the vaccine, or at least the first dose of that vaccine. And they're wondering how safe that process is. Is there a way that people can protect themselves while trying to get the vaccine?
Yeah, certainly. I think at most vaccination sites, you know, people are still being told to adhere to the social distancing. So definitely wearing your mask while you're waiting, while you're being vaccinated, maintaining the distancing, washing hands, all of that. That's really important, definitely while you're waiting for vaccination and while you're receiving the vaccine, doing the best you can, at least to stay masked.
And Namanjay, from your perspective, I mean, in terms of, there have been lots of concerns about equity and access to the vaccine, especially for communities of color. What are your thoughts on that? Have we seen anything to indicate that there needs to be better distribution or better information to communities of color?
Yeah, I think, as Apoorva mentioned, there certainly have been reports of inequities as far as distribution. You know, for me as a scientist, and you know, I'm a Black woman, I think a lot about equity even in how we develop these vaccines. So I think one thing that's important in the messaging and the education about them is that these studies that were done to establish the safety and efficacy of these vaccines were actually pretty diverse, more diverse than the studies used for many drugs that are approved that we take all the time. So I think we do need education around the fact that in, you know, African Americans, in Latinx folks, that these vaccines, you know, were the studies enrolled people in, you know, high numbers. These studies were about 9 to 10% African American, much higher than many drug studies, and that we're not seeing differences in safety and efficacy. So I definitely think that science needs to be communicated. And then the logistic issues, you know, is a little bit of a different thing. But at least if we educate folks, I hope that people will be comfortable trying to pursue getting the vaccine at least.
Namanjay Bumpus is director of the Department of Pharmacology and Molecular Sciences at Johns Hopkins University. And Apoorva Mandavilli is a science reporter at The New York Times. Namanjay, Apoorva, thank you for answering our questions.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with you on The Takeaway, I'm Tanzina Vega. And all this month, we've been checking in with leaders from around the country to get a sense of how vaccine distribution is going at the local level. Tribal nations and their members have been some of the hardest hit communities during the pandemic, and Indigenous people are 4 times as likely to be hospitalized from COVID-19 than white people, and more than 2.5 times as likely to die from the virus. That's according to data from the CDC. Now, particularly for tribes in rural areas, distributing COVID-19 vaccines can present an extensive set of logistical challenges. Today, we're checking in on vaccine distribution for the Cherokee Nation and the more than 140,000 citizens who live within the tribe's reservation boundaries. Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. is with me now. Thanks for joining me, Chief Hoskin.
Good to be with you, Tanzia.
So tell me, how many vaccines has the Cherokee Nation received so far, and have you been able to administer all the ones you've gotten?
Well, we are on a good pace as far as administering what we've got. We expect to hit about 10,000 vaccines administered this week at the rate we were going. And honestly, I think our system is going efficiently. My concern is just, will the government of the United States keep up with the Cherokee Nation?
So give us a sense of how that rollout is going, because as we've been following on this show, there are a patchwork, if you will, of success and not so successful vaccine rollouts across the country. The Tulsa World newspaper reported that your tribe has already moved into scheduling teachers, childcare workers, and people 55 and over. How's that going?
Well, it's going good as we moved into that phase. One of the advantages that I think we have is that we are a government and we're a society that believes that healthcare ought to be something everybody gets. And so when you have that mindset, you develop a system and develop an infrastructure to deliver that kind of healthcare. It's not that we're infallible, but I think it shows that it's a high priority. Then when pandemic hits, we are braced for it and prepared for it as best you can. And when something like a vaccine rollout hits, we do have the facilities in place to do that. And so it's gone well. One of the things that we have to deal with, that every government has to deal with, every health authority, is the different kinds of vaccines. So we have a largely rural population. We have the large health campus that we have can administer the Pfizer because we have the capabilities in terms of the cooling requirements. Out in the outlying communities, Moderna is a little easier to use, but of course, you don't know what your supplies are going to be for those two. And so that, I think, impacts our ability to get some of the more rural areas, the outlying areas. But so far, so good.
You mentioned that you are looking to see if the government can keep up with the Cherokee Nation. What are you needing right now?
Well, there's a variety of things. We want to make sure that we have the steady, consistent, reliable supply of vaccine because, again, our system is running well. So our system for vaccine administration includes reaching out to our patient population. We have the largest health system in all of Indian country. So we've reached out directly to those patients based on where they are in the phasing plan. And then we have a place for them to call in. That's gone very efficiently, but we want to make sure that the vaccines keep up. And I think just like any governor will tell you and your local health authority will tell you that if we see any slowdown in the distribution of the vaccine, then our best plans don't matter much. But I think so far, so good for us. And I think what I hear out of the Indian Health Service lately gives me confidence that they're going to keep up with the Cherokee Nation. So on the vaccine front, that's what we need. But of course, there's a whole host of things that jurisdictions across the country need to deal with COVID-19. Further response, which means further resources, and we have to recover at the same time.
What are you seeing is needed right now?
Well, I think across Indian country, supply is the most important thing. But one thing we have to remember is even though vaccine distribution is the most noteworthy thing lately, there still has to be an ongoing public health effort to keep people safe. So having consistent messaging out of the government of the United States about public health, that's as important now as it was before the vaccine came out, because it's still our best defense against this vaccine. I'm talking about wearing masks and social distancing. And I can tell you, as a tribal leader, who has done the same thing that many tribal leaders has done, which is let science drive our decision making, to hear a consistent message out of the White House, out of federal officials, is refreshing. I mean, it I can't emphasize enough how important that is when we're on the front lines trying to send that message and to have that kind of backup out of Washington, D.C. So that's important. We also need further resources to continue to address the impact of COVID on our communities. That can be infrastructure impact because our budgets have dwindled, because our revenues have dwindled from some of our business activities, such as gaming. It can also mean other healthcare resources, just so we can keep up with what we need done. And there's some parts in Indian country that I think many people in this country would be shocked and appalled that still exists. Some parts of Indian country with no running water, which makes it difficult in good times, certainly during a pandemic. That's not the case with Cherokee Nation, but it is the case in some parts of Indian country. So I think this ought to be a wake-up call for this country in terms of making sure that reservations, tribes across the country have even the basic things that most Americans take for granted.
One of the things that communities of color, particularly Black, Latino, and Native communities have is a somewhat of a mistrust of the U.S. medical system because of the history of discriminatory and racist treatments and experiments that have been conducted on these communities. What work has your government done to combat vaccine skepticism?
Well, one thing that it's important to understand about how medicine, how healthcare is delivered in Indian country is that it varies from tribe to tribe, and it varies as it has changed over time. So Cherokee Nation is an example of a tribe that, because of the resources we've been able to amass through our own business activities, gaming and whatnot, we have really taken control of our healthcare destiny. So I was born in 1975 in the Claremore, Oklahoma Indian Hospital, a federal installation. And the federal government, tries it might, has not delivered healthcare directly very good to Native Americans across the country. I'm talking in broad terms. Certainly there are exceptions. When Cherokee Nation began to develop resources, we started to take control of healthcare. And so even though we still hold the government of the United States accountable for dollars, for resources, we manage our healthcare system. And I think we do it better than anyone in the country. But that doesn't mean that there's not lingering distrust about healthcare among our people. I think particularly among an older generation of Cherokees. But I do think it makes a difference if tribes are able to, again, control their own destiny when it comes to healthcare, as we have done. And that builds confidence. I mean, it makes a difference when you walk into a healthcare facility and you see people you know, people you consider to be family, even if they're very extended family, because you know this is your government, the Cherokee Nation, operating this healthcare system. So I think had COVID hit a few generations ago, it would be a different story than it is today. I think we're better off today because Cherokee Nation operates its own healthcare system by and large.
Cherokee Nation, while you have kept coronavirus cases and deaths relatively low at a very difficult moment during the pandemic, the tribe has seen a spike in cases. What do you think accounts for that, as we're seeing similar spikes across the country?
Yeah, absolutely. So just overall, we've had over 13,000 positive cases just in our health system and 82 deaths. And it is true that we've fared better than many parts of the country, and even fared better, I think, than other parts of Oklahoma. But the fact is, we don't live on an island. And as the virus spreads, as people start to have fatigue over protecting themselves and others against the virus, as Thanksgiving and Christmas comes along, and of course, Cherokee people, like a lot of Native peoples across the country, very much gather on a regular basis with extended family and friends. And that, of course, is the worst thing you can do during the worst public health crisis, the worst pandemic in living memory. And so all of those things, I think, have conspired to increase the numbers. And I worry about all of our people, but I particularly jarred by this statistic, which is that we've lost over 30 fluent speakers, and we only have about 2,000 fluent speakers left. So in addition to being a pandemic that steals lives away from our people, that takes away precious lives, It takes also away a precious resource that is dwindling, which is our language. And so that's sort of another thing that weighs on us every day.
Does that mean that native speakers might be prioritized in the vaccine rollout because of that element that you're just describing?
Yeah, and that's exactly what we've done. But I really would take you back to March of 2020 when we decided to shut down all of our gaming operations and really go into kind of hunker down mode as people were learning about this virus. I was sitting with our deputy chief and he said, you know, chief, you just shut down all the casinos. There's perishable foods in all those refrigerators. So let's get them out to our fluent speakers. But we did more than that. We took our translators, our young people who are learning to speak Cherokee. We safely took that perishable food out to as many of our speakers as we could. And these are largely elders. And we also took and translated into Cherokee the best public health information that we had at the time. And so really, it's been a continuum of protecting our speakers. And then when we got the vaccine, or when we anticipated getting it, we put fluent speakers at the top of the list. And we've now vaccinated about 1,000 fluent speakers. That's about halfway to the total amount, but that is a great blessing because it means we've protected a really precious resource.
Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. is the principal chief for the Cherokee Nation. Chief Hoskin, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Tanzia.
There's a common saying that goes, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. But that isn't necessarily true today. More and more research tells us that middle-aged and older adults can learn new skills, and they can even become experts in everything from musical composition to beekeeping to learning a new language. First, we wanted to hear from our listeners over 60 about the new skills they've picked up during the pandemic.
Hi, my name is Denise McQuinn. I live in Dallas, Texas. I'm 67, and I've always read and exercised and studied new things. I love music of all kinds, like Black Pumas, Alan Stone, Seth Walker. I'm also politically active, and I help register voters, and I ship postcards to help flip Georgia blue. Just because you're older doesn't mean you lose your interest and sit down.
Hi, this is Nancy in Berkeley. I didn't set out to acquire a new skill, but I have done so kind of by accident. At the beginning of the pandemic, a cat rescue organization had to close down and empty out their adoption center. So they asked me to take in a couple of their unsocialized strays. The idea with socializing cats is to get them to where they like people and will make good pets. I'm getting more skilled at it all the time. I might as well, because I'm not going anywhere, and this is something useful to do, which is good not only for the cats, but for the people who adopt them.
More of our listeners have used this time to tap into their creative sides, whether that's meant getting crafty or learning an instrument.
Hi, this is Renee Button in Hillsboro, Oregon. I developed a new skill during this pandemic. I was going to make a quilt with the sewing machine I've used like 3 times in the last 20 years, and I couldn't get the sewing machine to work. So I did the whole thing by hand, and I ended up with a big quilt and 2 pillow shams that I made.
Hi, it's your friend Ellen in Pittsburgh. I acquired a new hobby. I have been repainting furniture and having a blast. My especially favorite thing to do is to paint filing cabinets. Boy, is that a piece of furniture you don't expect to have such a punch.
Hi, my name's Lucy, and I'm from rural Northwest Washington. I've started playing the guitar, and even with hit and miss practice, I've really found that it brings me so much peace and joy. I know, too, my husband has learned to sew, and he's 69. So you can always learn new things.
This is Doug in Portland, Oregon. A few years ago, I decided to try to learn ukulele, and in the last year, I'm proud to say I've gotten marginally better.
But your newfound musical chops aren't just instrumental. At least one of you is dropping beats in a different way.
Hi, I'm Robin Anderson. I am a retired woman in Portland, Oregon. And I wrote a rap tune about the COVID-19 virus and mask wearing.
It's a virus, people. It's basic biology. It's a virus, people. It can spread from you to me. It's a virus, people. Nothing political about it. It's a virus, people, and I'm sorry if you doubt it.
Rachel Wu is an assistant professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, and that's exactly what she studies. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Tanzina.
Why do we persist with this idea that older people are not good at learning new things?
I think because anytime you're learning, it's really difficult. And, you know, you might forget how difficult it is to learn, or you might see kids and babies learning easily, but they're actually having a hard time as well. But as adults, you know, we try to learn and then it's difficult. And then we think we're having a more difficult time, you know, than infants and kids. But that might not necessarily be the case.
So your research, you looked into this and you've had some research about the ability of older adults to learn new skills. We heard some older adults on our show earlier talking about all the new things they're doing. What does your research show?
So we basically show that a large proportion of why we think learning might be difficult is can be accounted for by the kinds of environment that we have when we're learning. So if you have a teacher teaching you, if you have people surrounding you who encourage you, if you put a lot of effort in, you know, all of these things. And what we did was we had older adults come in. They were about 60 to 80 years of age, so around 72-ish. And they came in to learn three new things at the same time. And so these were really difficult skills, like learning how to speak Spanish, read and write Spanish as well, photography, drawing, and things like that. And so they came in for 3 months and kind of, in a way, you know, did one quarter of university classes, if you want to think about it that way. And after even just halfway through 6 to 8 weeks or so, they increased their cognitive abilities, they increased their confidence. They, you know, were just all over, you know, a lot of them said they were different people, you know, by the end of it, for the better. And so in terms of their cognitive abilities, though, they were almost like, you know, middle-aged adults, so like 30 years younger, you know, looking 30 years younger in a way.
You said that you mentioned, you know, it's hard. We don't assume it's hard for babies and kids to learn new skills, but in fact, it is a challenge to learn new skills. What makes learning new skills different from being an adult versus a child?
So there are a few things that we've identified. One is babies have no bills to pay, no responsibility, really, you know?
I have one. I know.
We do everything for
yes,
them, right?
Yes, everything.
So, right. If you have an adult where everything is taken care of for you, how much easier is it to learn something, right? So if your full-time job, you know, and, you know, more, right, is learning new stuff, you know, how far can you get, really? So some of the things that we've identified are that babies learn really completely new things, right? And they're kind of in this open-minded, you know, state where they're not like saying, oh, I don't need to learn that. They're just learning whatever kind of comes to them. And another thing is, you know, they have somebody there pretty much 24/7 for whatever they need to learn, for all the skills that they, you know, need to learn. So, you know, if they want to learn the language that they're, you know, exposed to, there is somebody there 24/7 to teach them, right? That's not something that you typically get as an adult, unless you're trying to learn language from a spouse or something like that. But even then, it's kind of difficult. And then there's also this sense of a growth mindset. So instead of a fixed mindset where you don't think, as a parent, for example, you don't think your kids can, you know, be any good at, you know, sports or something, so you just don't push them in that direction. You know, like, especially with babies, you would never say something like, I don't think you would ever be good at speaking, so I'm just not going to teach you that. Like, that's just not something you say, right? Mm. You just help them and, you know, get them to where they need to go. So there's this really important growth mindset with especially with infants and kids. And then there's a serious commitment to learning as well. Babies are learning for survival. They're not just learning for fun, like, you know, hobbies or anything. They're really learning to survive, you know, essential skills. So there's this kind of commitment to learning where they just don't give up. And there's also a sense of, you know, it's okay to make as many mistakes as you want. in this recent book that was published by Tom Vanderbilt called Beginners, he notes like how many times babies actually fall by this research with Dr. Karen Adolf. And if you just look at, you know, yeah, babies eventually learn how to walk, but they also fall a ton of times, right? And it also helps that their body is a little bit rubbery as well, and so they can bounce back. And the last bit is that they're learning a lot, multiple skills at the same time. So it's not just one thing here and there. You know, there's something about learning multiple skills that keeps you going.
We are also, we're talking about the vaccine rollout, for example, and how complicated it's been. And largely, you know, we're saying, well, it's so complicated that, you know, it's largely because of all these portals and websites and the technology. But I even find some of that portals and websites and technology, you know, complicated at times. I mean, is there a reason why older people might struggle more with technology than younger people? Or is that also just an assumption?
It depends. I think, you know, some people will be similar and some people will struggle. But at the same time, you know, there are younger adults who are probably going to be struggling as well, right? Like, it's not, I don't think it's an age thing. I think it's more in terms of what kinds of systems you're used to, right? So if you've never seen a smart device in your life, then trying to navigate all these portals and everything will be difficult, especially if they're all through apps, you know?
Rachel, I have to ask you one more question, though, before we wrap, because I think for older people who might be interested in learning something new, we've got you on the line. What advice do you have for them?
It's okay to ask for help, you know, getting, you know, someone to teach you something. Not everybody's qualified to teach, you know, like adult children are not always the best way to go. But, you know, try to get some help and don't give up. And yeah, just keep going. You know, there's the main thing also, though, is that, if we do, if we're able to learn, you know, and stay independent, then we're able to, not have to rely on other people to do stuff for us.
And so that's something you think could be a motivating factor.
Exactly. Right. If staying independent is one of your main goals, in older adulthood, then learning new things is the way around that to make sure that you're not, you know, dependent on other people.
Rachel Wu is an assistant professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. Rachel, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks, that's all we have for you today. Really hope you enjoyed the show, and thanks as always for tuning in. If you want to share your thoughts with us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a voice memo, record it on your phone, and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.